Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back here. Hour number two of Monday Night Talk coming up later on this hour. Jean Bradley de Roncourt, at-large counselor in Brockton.
Yeah.
And he wants, he's going to talk a little bit about wanting folks to vote for him for a new position. We'll talk with him. But first, I got to say, this is Peter's favorite guest.
It is. This is
favorite.
My ultimate. Yes. I always ask him when you're going to be on, so I can be
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah.
Whenever he knows you're, he's like, oh, my God. He goes, what time's he on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So it was by chance that you two are here at the same time. And also, you had reached out to me, Casey Sherman, best-selling author. My goodness, so many hats. Boston Herald columnist. You do magazine pieces right now. We're going to talk a little bit about the piece you got in the Boston magazine. Founder of Fort Point Media.
TVs, movies, books. Yeah. King of all media.
We're going to talk a little bit about Turk, the movie. Anybody who's paying attention to hockey right now.
Right.
Hot property. Right. I'd have Dave on to talk a little bit, but he's a Canadiens fan, so.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's the one thing that we will never see eye to eye.
Oh, no. No. We actually had a little bit of a social media dust-up with Dave because he was making comments about Jack Edwards. And some people either like Jack Edwards or they just can't stand the guy. And he's like, the guy's a little over the top. But you're a Canadiens fan. He's like, he's a homer.
And I wouldn't call Jack a little over the top.
Oh, he's totally
Jack's totally over the top. But that's part of the circus. You know, that's part of the show.
And we've had him on this program, which is fantastic. And it was,
I interned for him 30 years ago at Channel 7 News. Yeah,
that's awesome.
When I was a young buck at BU.
Wow. My God. The things that you're involved with, it's and I was while we were in the break, I was saying to Casey, I don't think we can really, we just got to touch a little bit of the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg.
Just hit the highlights tonight. I think we'll be fine.
Let's talk about Turk, the movie, the movie about the former Boston Bruin, Derek Sanderson. You and Dave. Had a conversation with the person who's going to be your director.
Yeah,
right?
So you know, this is a project that's been in various stages of development for many years, and about a year ago, we wrestled control from a production standpoint of the project, and you know, so now Dave and I are producing the film with a co-producer out in L.A. named Michael Bassick, and he's always been somewhat involved with the project and has a very, very clear vision of a feature film. I have written the screenplay, and you know, we think we're just about there to start the next real phase of production. But in order to do that, you need the proper director. So you know, through our representatives in LA, we got the script to a bunch of different directors that we thought would do a hell of a good job with the story. But there was one that I was really championing from afar. And that was John Curran. John Curran had directed Chappaquiddick last year, which made a lot of top 10 lists around the country. And I just thought he had a real interesting voice. You know, here's a guy that could make, you know, Ted Kennedy empathetic, and yet you wanted to punch him every time you saw him on the screen in the film.
Right.
But at the end, you also had a little sympathy for him as well. And, you know, Derek Sanderson is a similar character to Ted in many ways. You know, these flawed heroes that we're so attracted to from an audience standpoint and really from a creative standpoint as well. So John gravitated toward the material. He's going to be directing Turk, which is fantastic. He and I are now still working, fine-tuning the script as we go. And hopefully within the next year, we put all the pieces together to, you know, get on the ice with this project.
So what happens next? Is it a matter of setting the budget, picking locations, casting, or am I putting the cart before the horse?
Yeah. So, Kevin, we'll talk. So basically, it could be all three of those things, but the one thing that doesn't happen first is the budget. Basically, you need a studio to set the budget. And in order to get a studio to set the budget, you need to package the project with great script, great director, great talent. And I think the next thing that we're going to be looking at is bringing in that actor that can pull off the physical scenes of Derek Sanderson, but can also really be deep in the emotional scenes that we need him to be.
Hmm. So who would you pick for an actor for that? Who's you have in mind?
I mean, I can't, you know, it's...
You don't want to. I don't know if he wants to throw it out there, but I think that...
I'll ask you guys.
Well, we couldn't have Adam Sandler, but...
Adam Sandler? No.
No.
In his first...
exactly.
Yeah, dramatic role. Yeah, exactly. No, that's...
But
look at Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks was, a comedian.
Yeah, but you need somebody that can come up through the ranks, because you're going to start him right from the beginning, right?
No, I mean, we have a certain entry point for his story, and that's been part of the problem with the project for so many years. There have been other screenwriters that have taken on this project, and some of them have started all the way from Derek getting his first pair of hockey skates.
Right.
Now, unless, you know, the world knows who Derek Sanderson is, you know, those scenes are kind of irrelevant. You know, we want to get right to the heart of Derek's story, to the heart of not only Derek's story, but his relationship with Bobby Orr's best friend, his mentor, and ultimately his savior in the film. So it's very action-oriented. It's also very dramatic. And we didn't have to overindulge the dramatic scenes, because they were all there. Derek had lived them. Mm. And Derek is such a very interesting character, even to this day. He'll regale you with stories for hours on end, and he's incredibly cogent with it and very smart. He's also a movie buff. So, he knows a good movie. He, appreciates our choice for a director in John Curran, because he did like that film. So we're going to look at this a bunch of different ways, and we'll find the right actor to play Derek.
Well, here's the key here, and maybe this is, I should have asked you this first. How accepting was Derek of your screenplay when you present it and go, this is what...
That's still a work in progress. You know, I mean, oftentimes you need separation of church and state when you're, writing a script about a real person. Mm. Oftentimes that's the last part of the puzzle, is getting them, comfortable with the material, because it's difficult to see your life, laid out there on the page.
Somebody else's set of eyes.
Right. And somebody else's set of eyes, and knowing that it's a film. It's not a documentary, and there are certain methods that you have to use in a feature film that you can't, that aren't available to you in a documentary, or vice versa. So we need to, change chronology, so to speak. We need to fictionalize some scenes to, get the spirit of what was happening across, but in a, 2 to 3 minute moment, as opposed to something that took over, 5 months.
So as a person that grew up with Derek, the Turk, and watching him play, and then following his, after he retired from hockey, and how he ended up his career, and how he reinvented himself, it was...
As a broadcaster.
Yeah, it's just amazing how he come back.
Yeah, and I think he needed a lot of help to do it, because he went, here's a guy that literally went from signing the richest contract in professional sports history. You know, he was making more money than Pele, than Joe Namath, than any baseball player in the world. He was a hockey player, playing for an expansion league, which is absolutely insane.
Right.
And within a short period of years, he was homeless, living on a park bench, fighting with other homeless people in Central Park in New York.
Wow.
So you see that, precipitous fall, and how he lifts himself up, or more importantly, how he's lifted up by others, including his best friend, Bobby Orr. That is ultimately the payoff for the audience at the end of the film.
See, I'm looking forward to that, because you are a proven, that's the reason why you're a bestseller when it comes to books, is you are a proven storyteller.
Appreciate that.
And there's
that,
art. There's an art to it. Not everybody can be successful when it comes to storytelling. I think you either have it or you don't. And you have it.
Well, it's a skill that you also work at over time.
Sure.
I've been, now writing almost 20 years in the news business for over 30. So, I've been telling people stories for as long as I can remember. And you have to continue to look to improve yourself when you're writing. And if you're not doing that, if you're being lazy and putting out the same material time and time again, which a lot of writers do, I need to challenge myself every time out, because that's the only thing that keeps me going and keeps me involved with all of these different projects that I'm involved in at any given time.
Yeah, let's switch gears, if you don't mind. Let's talk about this piece that you did. Folks, who live here on the South Shore, more and more when we turn on the news over the past couple of years, one thing that you hear and that you see is, on it with the warmer weather, shark sightings.
Right.
And you actually wrote a piece in the May issue of Boston Magazine, Blood in the Water. And this was about a deadly shark attack that took place in our waters just right down the coast.
Just right down the coast. It's the first deadly shark attack in Massachusetts since 1936.
Yeah, ages.
And, you know, the original premise of the film, getting ahead of myself. Sorry, guys. The original premise of the magazine article was to look at how the Cape Cod was going to respond after that attack from an economic standpoint, from a standpoint of public safety. And but as luck would have it, I tapped into an incredible person's story. And that person is Isaac Rocha. He's a 16-year-old junior at Everett High School. He's the only survivor of that deadly shark attack last September, when his mentor, his older brother, if you will, Arthur Medici, was killed by a great white shark. So for the first time ever, I take you inside of the water, inside the ocean, with Oscar as he's trying desperately to save his best friend's life. And it's a very powerful story and very amazing that this young man at 16 years old had the composure not only to survive that and go through that, but also the composure to sit down and talk to me very honestly about that experience. The magazine article itself, I think at times, is very emotional, but it's also incredibly inspirational and talks about the brotherhood and the love between Arthur, a 26-year-old college student from Brazil, and Isaac Rocha. And Arthur was engaged to marry Isaac's older sister. Wow. And when that happened, a life was lost. Family was torn apart. A whole peninsula in a region like we are here in the South Shore questioned safety patterns and what was going to happen in the future. And I can tell you, Peter, and I can tell you, Kevin, that, you know, there isn't any way to protect the public from great white sharks. They're out there. And the reason why they're out there is because the seal population has increased. Come back in abundance.
Exploded.
They were you know, wiped off the map in the 20th century because there was a bounty on their heads. And that stopped the traditional migration of seals in this area that's been happening for, you know, a million years. And once the seals' population came back, well, so did the sharks. And the sharks are going to stay around as long as the seals stay around. So no matter what level of public awareness you provide a swimmer, the swimmer has to know the ocean is where the sharks live. And when you go in there, you're taking literally your life in your hands when you do it. Arthur and Isaac did that. Only one of them came out alive.
It's interesting is to, you know, the line that you lead into your story, fantastic spread. Is it time to be afraid to go into the water? And speaking with this young man, did you just sense from him that it may be a long time before he ventures back into the water?
Yeah, Isaac told me, he said, Casey, I don't know if I'm ever going to go back into the water again. But he said, I don't have to, because I am back in the water every night with his nightmares.
All right.
He sees Arthur's face every single night. He sees that shark. He sees the blood. He had to swim through a river of blood just to get to his dying friend and drag him to shore, as opposed to swimming in the opposite direction and saving his own life. He put his own life up for grabs in the process just to save his friend. As I said, it's an emotional story, and it's something that we're going to have to face more and more so every summer. There was a shark attack in Plymouth a few years ago.
Right.
Two women were attacked. You know, we see sharks right off the coast here in Marshfield, again, where the seals are. That's where the sharks are going to be. So we can imagine that there are going to be more and more of these sightings, and unfortunately more of these tragic consequences.
Did you have a chance to speak with any local officials to kind of get their point of view?
Oh, sure.
About this? And what was some of the stuff that you were able to glean from them in regards to situations?
Some say kill them, some say protect them. And wow. I'm talking about the sharks, not the surface. You know, there are public officials down the Cape that want these sharks hunted down and killed. And if that can't happen, then they want the bounties reverted back on the seal population themselves. There is another side to this matter that think education is the key to protecting everyone. Now, the state has, they've tagged 150 sharks over the past 3 years. They've spotted 320 in the ocean around Cape Cod and the South Shore. I would say that there are probably three times as many great whites out there that they haven't spotted yet. And they're cognizant of that fact. The sharks aren't going anywhere anytime soon, you know, but there's also a trickle-down effect with the economy. Do tourists stay away from Cape Cod? Do they stay away from Brant Rock and Hummer Rock? I think the answer to that is no. They'll always come, but they should just be much better aware of their surroundings at any given time. Know that you don't have to be out at a certain distance to be attacked by a shark. Sharks are coming in to very shallow waters right now. You need a better and bigger presence of lifeguards. You need call boxes on beaches. You need more ambulances, more EMTs. You need that medical staff there and ready in case a swimmer or surfer is bitten to provide that medical attention on the ground instead of getting that person in an ambulance, driving 20-some-odd miles to Cape Cod Hospital and hoping for the best.
In writing this story, everything that you just mentioned in regards to having emergency services or call boxes, I mean, was any of that a detriment to this loss of life?
Unfortunately, it wasn't for this loss of life because Arthur bled out in the ocean.
Okay.
He was already dead when they brought him up. His young friend Isaac didn't believe it because he didn't see how badly Arthur had been attacked or bitten by the shark because he was towing him to shore, furiously. When he got there, he still couldn't believe it and hoped for the best, got into the ambulance, drove down to Cape Cod Hospital with his best friend, praying to God that it was all a bad dream. Called his mother, Isaac called his own mother and just said, get to Cape Cod, bring Emily, who was Arthur's fiance. What's happened to Arthur? I don't know, Mom. Just come down.
Wow.
And they did. And then that's when at Cape Cod Hospital, the doctors told them that there's no way they could help Arthur, that he had passed.
Again, we're speaking with the best-selling author, Casey Sherman. Talking a little bit about his piece in this month's Boston Magazine about a fatal shark attack that took place right off our coast. What was it like for you to sit there as he's describing seeing the dorsal fin pop out of the water and going, oh my God, what? And not only fearing for his his best friend's life, but his own.
You know, he's a very calm kid. You know, he's mature well beyond his years. Any 16-year-old, any 46-year-old, 56-year-old, would have panicked in that situation. I don't know what I would have done. You guys don't know what you would have done either. Isaac had taken ROTC classes in high school, so immediately his training kicked in. Ooh. And that's how when he swam to Arthur after hearing his friend scream, after seeing his friend's body thrashing and being thrashed by the shark and swimming through, as he described it, a river of blood to get to his friend, and then dragging him, some 30 feet, 30 yards, rather, to shore without any compunction about his own life being taken from him. It's an amazing thing that the young man did.
Peter, any follow-up question before we move on to talk a little bit about his Boston Herald articles?
No, he nailed it on the head. And I do go to Wrexham all the time, and the seals, I've never seen seals before, and they're there.
Again, Peter, where there's seals, there, there are sharks there. So,
exactly.
When people see them, to me, it's a get out of the water time, and I think more people realize that, the better.
I know that I've seen reports that there are communities that are trying these new buoys in the water.
Solar,
that will,
that'll
somehow give off a warning. Any thought as to just your personal opinion?
Personal opinion, I think anything helps. I don't think nothing hurts, but I do say that it's impossible to provide total safety for the swimmers out there when it comes to these predators. And again, the predators are just being sharks. It's all they know how to do. They're not necessarily attacking people for, you know, any reason, but they think it's a seal, or they think it's some other type of, you know, sea life that they snack on every day.
Again, we're speaking with Casey Schramm. Make sure you go to newsstands everywhere around the Commonwealth and grab this magazine. That's, I'm looking forward to my read, as Casey was kind enough to furnish me with a copy. And I think I want to talk a little bit about your work with the Boston Herald.
Sure.
There was an article, there was your latest column, well, at least the latest column that I saw, was in regards to kind of an early discussion about Mother's Day. And you talked a little bit about your mom.
Uh-huh.
It was interesting as to, you talk about, it was like an ode to your mom.
Right.
In regards to someone who persevered through family loss, how she was able to keep you on the right path, despite personal hardships. What was it like to kind of go down that road and talk about your mom?
Oh, I mean, you know, my mother's my hero. I talk about her all the time. But that story was published on her birthday when she was, she had just turned 73, and I thought this is a perfect opportunity a week before Mother's Day, mm-hmm. to, you know, tell the world, you know, about not only our relationship, but, you know, allow us to really appreciate the caregivers in our lives, whether they're mothers, grandmothers, yep. fathers, uncles, grandfathers, best friends, anybody that gives you the time, that doesn't give up on you. You mentioned, Kevin, that my mother had persevered through some hardship.
Yep.
As we all know, anybody that knows my background understands that, you know, I got into the writing business because my aunt Mary Sullivan was the final victim of the Boston Strangler
Correct.
Case. Well, Mary's younger sister was my mother, Diane. Mary was 17 when she lost her sister. You can imagine what kind of trauma that would, you know, take on a young woman. However, you know, she didn't become a perennial victim. She didn't let that identify her. She raised two kids basically on her own. My father died when he was young.
Right.
And my brother and I were hellions. We really were. We didn't give her a lot to hope for, quite frankly, in high school, because we were party boys and you know, made some mistakes. And when my father died suddenly when I was 17, I made some bad decisions. One of those bad decisions landed me in jail overnight. And I remember that, well, my mom's going to pick me up any minute now and take me home and treat me like her, you know, baby son.
And she didn't, did she?
No, she didn't. She left me there to stew a little bit.
Valuable lesson.
Stew, sober up. And I, you know, I mentioned in the column that I went through all my stages of grief at once about my dad, loss, denial, you know, final acceptance, anger, all of that.
Yep.
And by the time I got out, I had a clear vision of what I wanted to do. And I grew up on Cape Cod, very similar to the lives we live here in Marshfield.
Mm-hmm.
And everything reminded me of my father. And I knew that if I stayed where I was, I would commit some of the mistakes that maybe he made early on, and some of the mistakes that I would be able to blame on him. And I didn't think I'd survive. So I did tell her. My mother was a hairdresser. She ran her own little shop on Cape Cod. We were, you know, we weren't rich. We weren't, we were barely middle class. So to ask my mother, can I go away to boarding school, was asking like, well, you know, can you give me $1 million? It's $1 million she didn't have.
Sure.
And she looked at me, guys, and she said, well, if I do this, she knew, you know, I'm going to have to take on 2, maybe 3 jobs. And but I need to know that you're worth my investment. Are you worth it?
Yeah, I remember seeing that and you said, and you've actually proven.
I try, you know, but I think she wanted me to find value in myself, like it, which to me was the greatest gift. Asking me, are you really worth it? Do you think you're worth it? Because I had to say it for myself. It wasn't her, you know, she could have said, I think you're worth it, and yeah, you should go.
Hmm.
She looked me right in the eyes and said, are you worth it? And I said, yeah, I think I'm worth it. I know I'm worth it. And every day since 1986, I've been trying to prove that that correct.
Do you ever have a moment, do you remember the final scene of Private Ryan? When
yes.
when the older gentleman is, yeah. he goes over to the, while it's, I'm being a little more dramatic here, he goes, when Tom Hanks' character died, you know,
mm-hmm.
basically told him, you know, do something with yourself.
Yeah.
You know,
Pay it forward.
Pay it forward. Do you ever say to your mom, do you ever ask your mom, have I proven yet that I'm worth it?
No, I don't have to ask her that. She lets me know that, and now it's me leaving a legacy for my own kids. Not only the books that I write and the stories that I tell, but doing as much of that as I can for charity and for other people, using my platform to create a little good in the world, I think is something that they're going to be able to grasp when they're a little older. And then, they're going to pay it forward in their own way, I hope.
Peter, we just got a couple of moments left here, but I know you also have seen one of Casey's articles. Anything you want to touch upon real quick?
Frank Bertelli, the Navy SEAL.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, yep, that was amazing.
Well, that was today's article in the Boston Herald. And, Frank Bellotti is a guy that he was the AG of Massachusetts. He was former lieutenant governor. People knew his political career. Nobody ever knew that he was also a member of the first unit of the Scouts and Raiders, which was the precursor to the Navy SEALs. So he was the first naval unit on land in World War II, fighting the Japanese, involved in sabotage and bombing raids, etc., putting his life on the line every day. Never told anybody about it. He told a friend of mine who told me, I got in touch with Frank. I said, the world needs to hear this story, Frank. And we published the story today. It's gotten great response.
Yes.
And very proud to meet and tell the stories that I can do.
So I'm bummed out we don't have more time. That's why I said we need like an hour, because I wanted to talk a little bit about the Northeastern University.
Oh, sure.
Dirty little secret. I don't know if you want to touch upon that.
Yeah, we'll do it very quickly. Northeastern University houses the collective of the old Boston Phoenix newspaper, which is a, long since retired alternative newspaper in Boston. And if you go onto the Northeastern website, all it talks about is the intrepid reporters of the Phoenix and all the great work that the newspaper did. And they did a lot of good work. What they failed to even discuss in the collection is the fact that the Phoenix was getting 30 to 70% of its revenue at times through prostitution and human trafficking ads.
Yep.
And my question was, okay, Northeastern, put out the collection, but tell this side of the story too.
Right.
That's all I asked. Northeastern has since completely shut down. They refuse to acknowledge it. A lot of the former Phoenix reporters have all circled the wagons and are quite angry with me, as opposed to saying, you know what? Pretty good point. We should have probably looked at that a little closer, because there are things in my news past that I wish I'd done differently. And, hindsight's 20/20, but
absolutely.
Recognize it, talk about it.
Lesson learned,
that's all.
Anything you want to say in closing, my friend? If folks want to find out more about what Casey Sherman is up to.
Yeah, well, that's great. Find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter, Casey Sherman 123. We've got a lot of different movies and books in the works. Dave Wedge and I are writing the final chapter of the Whitey Bulger saga called Misery Mountain, which focuses on
the... You had a chance to go out and see the compound, right?
We were the only journalists that have ever been allowed inside Whitey's apartment, his lair, since he was captured. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in the book, but it's really the 16-year manhunt, how they got him, which is a part of the story that has been underreported, quite frankly, and it's fascinating to me. It's almost like the movie Zero Dark Thirty and how they got Bin Laden. It was a very small task force of 2 to 3 people. Nobody even cared about Bulger anymore. They were focused on terrorism and all that stuff. These three people brought the guy to justice.
We'll have to look forward to that. Casey Sherman, our guest. Casey, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it always.
Got it. We're going to step aside and the final segment of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.